you can't help but have seen the discussion in the newspapers and the radios and whatnot over the last few weeks and months concerning the possibility of the United States of America going to war and invading Iraq. And, of course, we've been over the past year involved in Afghanistan and have had fighting there. And there is the possibility, a lot of discussion about the possibility of many Americans, thousands of Americans, being involved in fighting over there, and who knows what may come of all of that. But given the war clouds gathering, it's appropriate for Christians to ask the question, what does the Bible say about these kinds of things? What should the Christian's role be in these kinds of things? And so back home in Centerville, Virginia, I began a series last week trying to look at some of those questions, because the Bible has some things to say about those things. And so last week was the first lesson in that series. That first lesson really didn't get into a whole lot of question about exactly what can a Christian do, or should a Christian do, or can a Christian do anything in terms of fighting. It was really an introductory lesson designed to say, how should we think about this? What should be our attitude as we ask this question? From what perspective should we ask this question? And I'm not going to this morning try to get into the question a whole lot of what a Christian's responsibility or rights or duties are in terms of war, but I want to present that first lesson to you because it has application to just everything that we do. How should we ask these questions? With what perspective should we ask these questions? This question and many others. And what I'm going to say is really, we need to come to that topic and all others as citizens of a heavenly kingdom. That's how we have to address it. And the comments are really prompted, or the catalyst for the comments, is a little book that somebody loaned me, Will the Real Heretics Please Stand Up? And I'm going to have a little bit to say about this book. The reason I want to present this lesson to you all today is, number one, as I said, has something to do with the attitude or perspective that we bring to all such issues. But number two, you'll gain some insight into the perspective of many of our religious neighbors, people who are members of one denomination or another, may seem like conservative Bible-believing people. You'll get some interesting insight. Now, how does all that fit together? Well, that's my task this morning, is to try to bring this all together in some way that you get something out of it. This book is written by a man who's an evangelical. And I want to suggest to you that it'd be helpful to understand what an evangelical is. How many of you have heard the expression evangelical? Raise your hand if you've heard. Okay, nearly everybody's heard that expression. These people are, often they're Baptists. They may be Presbyterians. Some of your Lutherans are going to be evangelicals. Basically, they are the people in the religious world who are Protestants and are conservative in the sense that they believe the Bible is the inspired Word of God. They believe the miracles that are described in the Bible really happened. They believe the Lord is coming again. They believe there's going to be a day of judgment. These people are your evangelicals. More and more, they are tending to have less and less of a denominational identity. More and more frequently, you'll hear them speak of themselves as Christians, and they may worship with a Baptist church or a Presbyterian church or an Assembly of God or something like that, but they'll often have little loyalty to the denomination, and they may float from one denomination to another. They may move from this town to another, and when they do, they were Baptists here, but they'll become Presbyterians there. That happens. But they tend to think of themselves as Christians, and in fact, they really, in their mind, are the true Christians. They look at the evangelical world as true Christianity, as opposed to something out there that's a false Christianity. There are certain doctrines that characterize them. They believe faith only is required. They don't believe anything beyond faith is required to be saved, to become a Christian. They believe our works are unrelated to our salvation. And many of them believe, once you're saved, you cannot be lost. Once saved, always saved. They don't all believe that, but they all have a real problem with the possibility of apostasy. Some of them will grant, yes, you can fall away, but they have a hard time with that. And the reason they have a hard time with that is because fundamentally they are characterized by a doctrine that says man, as of Adam and Eve's sin, became depraved, his nature was corrupted such that he cannot choose to submit his will to God. And therefore, if he can't do that, how in the world could he choose once he has been chosen by God? How could the man then do anything that would sever his relationship with God? The Bible happens to be so plain on the fact that you can fall from grace that many evangelicals have said, well, okay, I guess you can, but it just seems like it's really hard to. And so you have that kind of a problem in the evangelical world. I want to set forth for you the evangelical view of history, and that will provide the framework for what we want to do this morning. They look at the New Testament, and that's God's Word for us today, and then they talk about what you see in the 2nd century and the 3rd century that was written by the next generation of people as representative of apostolic Christianity. We see that is really just the same thing as what you have in the New Testament. And they consider that to be orthodoxy. However, sometime in the 2nd and 3rd century, we began to see a problem come along, and that was Gnosticism, which is kind of an umbrella term that refers to some people who taught various things. For example, they taught that everything physical is corrupt, and that salvation has to do with an intellectual kind of thing, and some of them taught it really doesn't matter how you live. And in response to the Gnostics, who were the heretics, there were the various councils that came along, and you had gatherings of people from the all around the Mediterranean world who would come together in some city, and they would sit down and say, the Gnostics are heretics, the Gnostics are wrong, here is the apostolic teaching, here is orthodoxy, and they would come out with some kind of a statement and decrees, which the evangelicals looked at, and they say, okay, that's holding the line for what was taught in the New Testament, what was apostolic Christianity. But unfortunately, out of those councils evolved Roman Catholicism, or the Catholic Church, which blended a lot of these things with a lot of paganism, and so you get Roman Catholicism. But as the evangelicals look at it, we come down in time, and there's a Reformation that takes place. And the corruptions and the misguided doctrines that characterize Roman Catholicism are reformed and corrected, and you have the Reformation. And then out of the Reformation comes what we see today. We have Protestantism, and the Protestants can be divided into two camps. I'm running out of room on the board, so I'm going to have to abbreviate. CP, you just got to remember, CP is conservative Protestantism. Conservative Protestantism. So what would LP be? Liberal Protestantism. And that's the religious world of Protestantism that you see today. Guess who the evangelicals are? Well, the evangelicals are the conservative Protestants. And this is their view, what I've put up here is their view of religious history for the last 2,000 years. And they look at, of course, liberal Protestants as having basically denied the faith. And they look at such groups as the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormons and various other groups like that as heretics, as people who are not holding to the orthodoxy that you saw back in the 2nd and 3rd century, and they see themselves with CP, conservative Protestants, or evangelicals. They see themselves, the evangelicals, as holding to the apostolic Christianity, the orthodoxy that you see in the New Testament, and more especially in the 2nd and 3rd century. Alright, that's the historical framework that we want to talk about. And against that framework, this man, Burkhoff, wrote this little book, who is a self-identified evangelical, says, you know what? When we consider ourselves to be orthodox in terms of what was back here, he says, we're not really. And he says, we need to ask the question, will the real heretics please stand up? It's a call for self-examination and introspection on the part of evangelicals. And there's some lessons in here for us, because we need to do the same kind of self-examination, engage in the same kind of introspection, and ask the question, why do we believe what we believe? He is going to develop the thesis that modern-day evangelicals really believe what they believe, not because they are following the New Testament or apostolic Christianity. He's going to develop the thesis that they are conforming to something other than the Bible. Well, there's going to be a lesson. This will be interesting. Just talk about them. But there's a lesson for us. Are we doing the same thing? Now, let me take you back to the first thing that I said we're going to talk about in the lessons that I'm presenting down at the Centerville. We're going to talk about the question of, can a Christian go to war? How do we approach that question? Well, we have to approach it as citizens of a heavenly kingdom. And that's really the thing that he develops here. And so I'm going to get at this by asking two questions. I'm going to ask the question, who should we be? And then we're going to ask the question, who are we? Who should we be, and who are we? Two questions. First of all, who should we be? Citizens of a heavenly kingdom. You know, one way to talk about why it is that Jesus was crucified is that he was seen as a rival of a worldly ruler, a rival of Caesar. Now, he was crucified because it was God's plan for our salvation. And yet, if we look at John, the 19th chapter, we see that when Jesus had refused to answer a question that Pilate had asked, Pilate had said, don't you know I have power to release you and I have power to crucify you? And Jesus told him, you wouldn't have any power against me except it were given you from above. And Pilate responded, Pilate responded to that by seeking to release Jesus. By seeking to release Jesus. And then the Jews said, if thou release this man, thou art not Caesar's friend. Everyone that maketh himself a king speaketh against Caesar. See, Pilate, he is under the authority of Caesar. And if this man, Jesus, is a king, why then he's a rival to Caesar. And if you release Jesus, then you're taking the side of a rival to Caesar. And you're not a friend of Caesar. And so Pilate therefore heard these words. He brought Jesus out and sat down in the judgment seat, proceeded to convict Jesus and to have him crucified. In John 18, verse 36, even though Jesus was indeed a king and is indeed a king, we find that his kingdom is not of the sort that Caesar's was. He says, my kingdom is not of this world. In reality, you could say he was a rival to Caesar, but not on a plane with Caesar. And his kingdom is not of the sort that Caesar's was. In Colossians chapter 1 and verse 13, Paul says, we have been translated into that kingdom, into the kingdom of the Son of God's love. In Philippians chapter 3 and verse 20, our citizenship is where? Our citizenship is in heaven. This has practical implications. I think it's easy for some to think, well, being a Christian means citizens of a heavenly kingdom. Oh, that's good. It must not have any responsibilities here on earth then. It doesn't really impact the way I live here on earth. But it does. In Romans 12 chapter and verses 1 and 2, we find we are not to be fashioned according to this world. And in the passage that Mike read just a moment ago, let's turn over to 1 Peter chapter 2. Verse 9, we are an elect race, a royal priesthood, but notice the expression, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. Verse 10, who in time past were no people, but now are the people of God. God has a people. That's not just a plurality of persons, that is a nation. It's a holy nation, And what does that have to do with, what's the implication for how we live in this life here? As citizens of the United States of America, for example, verse 11, beloved, I beseech you as sojourners and pilgrims. That's how we look at our life here, because our citizenship is in heaven. What's a sojourner? Well, I tell you what, Dad mentioned being in the Czech Republic. When he was in the Czech Republic, he was a sojourner in the Czech Republic from a worldly standpoint, because his citizenship from a worldly standpoint is the United States of America. But from a spiritual standpoint, our citizenship is in heaven, which means that everything we do on this planet, we do as sojourners. And Peter said, I beseech you, as sojourners and pilgrims, to abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, and so on. Now he goes on to then say, you know what, we'd better live in subjection to man's ordinances here in this life. We can't just say, well, I'm a citizen of a heavenly kingdom, so I don't have to obey the laws of this land. No. Because we are citizens of a heavenly kingdom, we need to live orderly lives, so that as the Gentiles look at us, and wherein they speak evil against us as evildoers, they will behold our good works, and they may glorify God in the day of visitation. They will not have any ground upon which to accuse us. They may think us strange, though, because we're going to be different. Because we are citizens of a different society. 1 Peter 4th chapter and verse 4, right after the passage about winebibbers that Dad mentioned in the previous hour. Verse 4, Peter says, you know, these people are going to think of you as strange. He says, wherein they think it strange that ye run not with them in the same excess of riots, speaking evil of you. And so they're going to look at us and they're going to see we don't engage in some of the same things they engage in. There's a difference, and there ought to be a difference. There's a difference that is a manifestation of our heavenly citizenship. And then down in verse 12, beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial among you, which cometh upon you to prove you, as though a strange thing happened unto you. But insomuch as you are partakers of Christ's sufferings, rejoice, that at the revelation of his glory also ye may rejoice with exceeding joy. That's how we are oriented. And in this lifetime we're going to be thought strange, and we may be persecuted. But you look at Peter, and he's writing about people who lived in Roman society, and their loyalty, though they were to submit to the laws of that society, was not primarily to Caesar. And our loyalty, brethren, cannot be primarily to America. We are not Americans, first and foremost. In fact, fundamentally, if we are God's, we are not Americans. Now let me tell you how I mean that. I have a daughter who got married in May, and I haven't gotten figured out how all that affects how you talk about relationships. That means I have a son-in-law now, and he has a father. And that son-in-law, with all the hyphenation in there, how do you say my son-in-law's or son's-in-law's father? I don't know how you talk, but that guy, the father of my daughter's husband, is a Texan. Anybody here a Texan? Anybody in here ever met a Texan? Oh, wow. Okay, you've met a Texan. Texans are interesting people. They have a novel way of looking at their citizenship. And he really impressed it upon me, as it had never been impressed before. He said, you know, we Texans, we really think of I think of myself as Texan more than I think of myself as American. Now, that's shocking for the rest of us in the United States of America, but that's what he said. And I believe that many of them feel this way. He says, you know, we're the only state that was a country, and we have the right to fly our flag on a level with the United States flag because we were a country. And then we kind of joined this other country, and we don't necessarily like everything this other country is doing, but we decided to go along with this other country, namely the United States of America, for a while. But we're really Texans, and we're kind of going along with it. But I tell you what, if we're citizens of a heavenly kingdom, we are really Christians. Now, for a while, we are sojourning with this other country, the United States of America, in a way. And we better not like everything that's going on in the United States of America. But we're going to sojourn here, and we're going to abide within the laws as far as they're consistent with our Christian conduct that our government has. But we are not fundamentally Americans. We're citizens of heavenly kingdom. Okay? So that's how we have to look at all of this. That's what we should be. Now let's ask the question, who are we? And that's really where this book is very interesting. Because he asks this question with the evangelicals in mind. He says, who are we? And Don, what basis do we make our decisions? And his point is that he believes modern evangelicals are not so much followers of Christ as they are conformists to their culture. And he would define their culture as being the conservative movement, or maybe the conservative religious movement, in United States of America. They think they are being true to orthodoxy. He says, not really. And he shows they're not. And he says they're really conformists to their culture. Some movie... Did we get started at 11 o'clock? I saw a movie a couple weeks ago. It was Cry of the Beloved Country. It's a movie about apartheid in the 40s in South Africa. And in the movie, there's a young white man who has become a champion of the blacks in South Africa, and he is killed by a black. And the father of the black that he's killed by is a religious man. He's a clergyman. And the father of the white man that is killed is a white bigot, a racist. And in the process of the movie, as it plays out, these two men come to know each other. And the white man really goes through a transformation. The thing that is the beginning of the turning point for him is when he reads a letter his son was writing when he was killed by the black man. And he reads this letter in which the son says, "We," meaning the white settlers in South Africa, the white people who were in control, he says, "We say we are Christians, but what we really mean is we are white." Now, without going into all of the movie, that's kind of a stunning statement. That's something that happens. A group of people who have various things in common, including a religious viewpoint, will begin to speak of their culture, whatever it is they have in common, as if that's what is Christianity. That's us. Well, we're Christians. And this culture that we share, this group of people, well, that must be what a Christian is all about. And the question then to ask is, the question that this man asks, when evangelicals say they are Christians, are they really just saying they're conservative religious Americans? And then if that's what they're saying, is their citizenship really in heaven, or is it in this culture here? There's a question here we can ask, isn't there? It's a question here we can ask ourselves. Well, all right. Let's look at... I want to mention this, by the way. Talking about identifying oneself in terms of one's culture, and saying, well, I'm white, meaning I'm a Christian, meaning I'm white, or saying I'm a Christian, meaning I'm a conservative religious American. What one fails to do is to deny his culture. And you think about what Jesus calls upon us to deny is not merely our culture, but ourselves. So that's profound. Well, one other piece of work we need to do before we get into some particulars. Bertone, the author of this book, takes modern evangelicals to task, first of all, by saying, do we really teach the same things that were taught by those who held to orthodoxy in the 2nd and 3rd century? If there's a flaw in the book, it is this. He focuses upon what was taught in the 2nd and 3rd century rather than focusing especially on what was taught in the New Testament. If we really want to be citizens of a heavenly kingdom, and if we really want to be sure we are conforming not to some group of men but to our God, then we have to go all the way back to here, not just all the way back to here. But for his audience, because he is writing to conservative Protestants, evangelicals, whose identity they think is inherited from here, his point is appropriate and well made and well taken. Alright, we're ready to look at the particulars now. He talks about divorce, and he goes through the writings of some of the people like Origen, Irenaeus, and Tertullian, and Justin Martyr, and these people who lived in the 2nd and 3rd century, and they wrote about Christianity, and believing they were Christians, and without getting into the question of whether they were or whether they weren't,
they wrote talking about society of their day, how evil it was, and what Christ calls upon us to do. And they talked about divorce and how wrong divorce was. And here's what this man says in this book about this. He says, 40 years ago, an evangelical Christian wouldn't have dreamed of divorcing his or her spouse merely because of incompatibility. But then he says the divorce rate among evangelicals is fast approaching that of the world. You know, 40 years ago, that's 1962. In 1962, among your Baptists, among your Presbyterians, among your church-going people, divorce was still considered scandalous. That was not a good thing. Among your Baptists, among your Presbyterians, what's true today? Why, divorce is just, as he says, divorce is fast approaching, the divorce rate among evangelicals is fast approaching that of the world. What has changed? He asks. Certainly not Scripture. Scripture hasn't changed. Rather, the conservative block of American society has changed its views on divorce. Evangelicals often pride themselves for opposing worldly attitudes and trends, but in reality, what we so often oppose is merely the liberal segment of the world, liberal Protestantism and just liberals in general, but in reality, what we so often oppose is merely the liberal segment of the world. Once a practice is accepted by the conservative element, the church soon follows in stride. Okay, you understand the kind of point he's making. He comes to the topic of abortion. And it's kind of interesting what he says here. He says, admirably, evangelical Christians today have generally stood just as uncompromisingly against abortion as the early Christians did. You've gone back and you've talked about some of the writings of these people in the 2nd and 3rd century and showed what their attitude would be with regard to something like the, abortion, and that they would condemn such. And then he says, you know, so far, evangelical Christians, as he calls them, have stood uncompromisingly against abortion. I hope that our stance is completely independent of our culture. But I don't know that it is. The conservative bloc of American society hasn't yet accepted abortion. When you get out of Protestantism, you just look at conservative people in the United States of America generally, they're still generally pretty squeamish about abortion. They don't like that idea. And he says, conservative lawmakers and justices are normally opposed to it. If their attitudes change, will ours follow suit? Right now, it seems impossible that we would ever change our attitudes on abortion. If you think about it, a good Southern Baptist denomination, a congregation somewhere, or Assembly of God, it's almost unthinkable to think that a pastor would stand up in one of those churches and say, abortion is fine, abortion is okay, isn't that? But he says, however, a century ago, nobody dreamed that divorce would someday be commonplace in the evangelical church. Okay, you see what he's doing, right? He's making a powerful point here. Well, he talks about fashion, modesty in how we dress. And he says this. He goes back, he talks about what was taught back here and how that was different than the lewdness and lasciviousness that characterized 2nd and 3rd century society. But he says, don't we Christians generally follow right along with our culture? We appear in public in swimwear that would have shocked even non-Christians only 50 years ago. When's 50 years ago? 1952. You think about what you see in public, on the public beach down here in the park or whatever, today. In 1952, that would have shocked the world generally. To see that kind of, you can go into a shopping mall and see things that would shock people in 1952. And he says, that kind of dress that would have shocked people then is now characteristic of these evangelicals. Yet because our swimwear is acceptable to the modern conservative community, we think nothing of it. He makes a similar point about entertainment. He talks about the role of women. This is interesting. After your comments this morning, you'll find this interesting. You've read this book, haven't you? Parts of it. Okay. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, he cites verses 34 and 35, where, as in all the churches, Paul says, let the women keep silence, for it is not permitted them to speak. Talking about in the church, in the assembly. And he talks about 1 Timothy chapter 2, in verses 11 and 12, where Paul says, a woman is not to have authority over a man. She is to learn in quietness.
And he mentions, Burkott does, he mentions the claim that these passages reflect the culture of their time. Many of the people in these churches down here will look at 1 Corinthians 14 and 1 Timothy 2 and they'll say, well, what Paul was doing, he was just reflecting the culture of his time. Times have changed. Burkott goes back and shows, no, he wasn't reflecting the culture of his time. That in the first century it was not true that women were regarded as people who had to be silent in public assembly or in religious assembly. And he talks about the religious assemblies of the pagans and so on and the influential and leading role that the women played in all of that. And he says, no, Paul was not saying something that was just a reflection of his times. He was saying something that was from God. And he argues that the people who ignored those teachings were the heretics. And he talks about among the heretics you could find the women performing the leading roles in the religious gatherings. And then he asks, why is it that the role of women in the church, meaning today, has become such an issue today? Is it because our culture says that men and women should not perform different roles? It's ironic. The people down here who say, well, Paul just said that because of his culture. Burkott says, you're just saying that because of your culture. That's ironic. It's interesting. Insightful. He talks about faith only. Evangelicals fundamentally believe we are saved by faith only. And they say they are being orthodox. And he goes back here and he says, did they teach faith only back here? He talks about how that faith only is a defining doctrine or a defining doctrine for the evangelical movement. How they use that to distinguish between those who are orthodox and the heretics. They'll talk about the Jehovah's Witness and the Mormons as being heretical because they don't teach faith only. And then he goes back and he cites what he calls 10 early Christians. In fact, he says every early Christian writer, meaning in the 2nd and 3rd century, who wrote on this subject, he shows they did not believe faith only. Well, of course, we're concerned with going all the way back to the Bible. But he is concerned with going to the 2nd and 3rd century because these people believe they are the heirs of the 2nd and 3rd century orthodoxy. There's a reason why we're doing it this way. We'll see in just a moment. He discusses the role of works and grace conditioned upon obedience. He talks about the logical implications of all of that. He talks about how that pertains to being to once saved, always saved, and that idea. And after going through all of that, showing that they didn't teach once saved, always saved, we do. They taught that grace was conditioned upon obedience. We deny that. They did not teach faith only. We do. After doing all that, he says, do you know who it was back here in the early centuries who taught that man is so depraved that he can't do anything and that it doesn't matter how he lives and that basically you're saved by faith only? Yeah, the Gnostics, the heretics. And so Burkott says, will the real heretics please stand up? What he does is he says, we are the heirs of the heresy that was opposed to what we claim was orthodox. That's what he claims as he talks about the modern evangelical movement. And then he talks about that. And he shows that in the 2nd and 3rd century, those who wrote clearly understood baptism is necessary for the remission of sins. And he has an interesting passage. Interestingly, we evangelicals seem to recognize the need for some type of initiation ceremony or rite of passage to mark the Christian rebirth. You go into a Baptist church, you go into an Assembly of God, or you go in. There's something that they will tell you you have to do or that happens, and that's when you become a Christian. Even though they've said you're saved by faith only, there's something that they want you, they found fascinating. You need some kind of initiation ceremony or rite of passage. Well, he goes on, he says, but strangely enough, we have generally rejected the historical ceremony of the baptismal rebirth and have developed our own special ceremony, the altar call. When Peter preached to the Jews on the day of Pentecost, his hearers asked him, what shall we do? He's citing Acts 2, verse 37. Did Peter tell them to walk up to the front of the crowd and invite Jesus to come into their hearts? No. He told them, repent and let every one of you be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of your sins. That's an evangelical saying that. His point is, who are we?
Are we citizens of a heavenly kingdom? Or have we conformed to something else? We say we are orthodox. We say we conform to this. We need to conform to this. But he says, we say we conform to this. We haven't, he says. We don't teach the same thing they taught. Even on baptism, he says, we don't teach the same thing they taught. Then what have we conformed to? He says they conform to a modern conservative movement. Well, the reason, of course, that I was presenting this lesson in Centerville, Virginia, is because it's the beginning of a series on the question of war and a Christian participating in war. He addresses that in this book. And he says the evangelical view is that it's all right for a Christian to go to war to kill for his government. He observes that no war in U.S. history has been opposed in significant numbers by evangelicals. And he shows that, in fact, he cites anecdotes from his own experience to demonstrate that the evangelicals have typically reacted in the same way as the world around them when, say, we've been attacked or whatever, with basically a let's get them kind of mentality. Let's respond and let's get them back. And then he asked the question, was that the view of these people in the second and third century? And he demonstrates clearly, no. Those people believed that that was wrong. It's wrong to go and kill. And so again, he makes the point, are we really, meaning the modern evangelicals, are we really orthodox? Are we heretics? He makes a similar point regarding capital punishment. And he goes a little bit further with it. And he argues why one can look at the Old Testament and see God's people killing, and yet come to the conclusion, and yet we can come to the conclusion that God's people today shouldn't do that. And he argues it's because morality changed from the Old Testament to the New Testament. I don't think I would go with him there. I don't think I would agree that morality has changed from the Old Testament to the New Testament. I think there's some things that changed. We had in the Old Testament, there was the Avenger of Blood. Jim, you don't have, yes, you have a brother. If I killed Jim in the Old Testament, what would Jim's brother be doing? He'd be coming after me. And what would I be doing? Well, God provided a place, a city of refuge. 48 cities of refuge, if I remember right. And I could go run into one of those cities. And there were rules. I could go into that city and I could stay there until the priest died and I would be okay. If I came out of there before the high priest died, his brother could get me. The Avenger of Blood concept. Well, that was in the Old Testament. Do any of us believe that's the way it should be, that Christians should think in those terms today? That if I killed Jim, that his brother has right to come kill me? Do any of us believe that? No, we don't. So yes, there's some fundamental things that have changed with respect to the idea of taking life from the Old Testament to the New Testament. I still wouldn't say, though, morality has changed. Let me put it this way. What is common from the Old Testament to the New Testament is that the taking of life is God's prerogative. It's God's prerogative. If God tells a man, you kill that man, then the man can kill that man, and it is God's judgment. It's God's doing. The man is just an agent doing God's will. If God tells a man, in such and such a circumstance, if this happens and then that and so forth, then you've got to kill a man, then whenever that circumstance arises, the man who was told that better kill that man, and it's God's problem. Man doesn't have the prerogative to take life. In the Old Testament, in many different times, in many different circumstances, God, either specifically or in principle, told somebody, kill. And when they did so, it was consistent with the principle that killing is God's prerogative, not man's. And the question that we're going to be pursuing in the next 2 or 3 or 4 weeks in Centerville is, when God speaks to us in the New Testament Scriptures, has he ever told us, you kill this man, or in this circumstance, you kill somebody? If we can find that, then we can kill in that circumstance, and we can say, it is God's prerogative. But if we can't find that, and we choose to kill anyway, we have done a terrible thing. We have usurped, we have arrogated to ourselves the prerogative of God. So that's what we'll be talking about in Centerville in the coming weeks. But you can see why
I would introduce this topic from the standpoint of how do we analyze this kind of question, with what perspective? Not as Americans. Not as patriotic Americans. It's fine to be patriotic, and it's fine to love this country, and there's a lot of things to learn to love about this country, and I believe, as I'm sure many of you believe, that this country has been specially blessed by God. But we cannot make decisions about what's right or wrong from the viewpoint of a patriotic American whose land has been attacked. We have to answer those questions as a citizen of a heavenly kingdom whose God rules over all and who has told us what is right and wrong. We also cannot answer such questions in terms of some culture smaller than the society of the United States of America that we may have identified ourselves with, whether it be secular or religious. We can't look at ourselves in terms of, well, I'm a member of a certain religious movement or a certain group of churches, and say, well, I'm going to believe what I believe because, after all, that's what we believe. We are citizens of a heavenly kingdom. And that's the perspective we have to bring to all of these things. Well, I will stop there. I think I've passed time a little bit. So let's stand and sing the song that's been announced.
Have thine affections been nailed to the cross? Is thy heart right with God? Dost thou count all things for Jesus but lost? Is thy heart right with God? Is thy heart right with God? Washed in the crimson blood, cleansed and made holy, humble and holy, right in the sight of God. Hast thou dominion o'er self and o'er sin? Is thy heart right with God? Over all evil without and within, is thy heart right with God? Is thy heart right with God? Washed in the crimson blood, cleansed and holy, humble and holy, right in the sight of God. Are all thy powers under Jesus' control? Is thy heart right with God? Does each moment abide in thy soul? Is thy heart right with God? Is thy heart right with God? Washed in the crimson blood, cleansed and made holy, humble and holy, right in the sight of God.
Knowing that none of you probably plan to be in Centerville, Virginia for the next 2, 3, 4 weeks, I might as well go ahead and give you the bottom line. In answer to the question, this is what I believe. I don't believe we're going to turn to the New Testament and find where God has given us specific instruction to kill, or specific circumstances in which he said, here's when I want you to kill, or here's when you shall kill. If you want the full story, though, and you happen to be down our way, feel free to stop in the next 2, 3, 4 weeks. Thank you.